Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Well, if there are two common themes locally, nationally, internationally, whether we're talking the halls of the International Criminal Court or the halls of Manhattan Criminal Court, there seems to be pandemic chaos and confusion. In times like these, we need a man who can help us make sense of it, or at least understands what the concept of freedom is, or at least what it used to be. Who better to turn to than the host of the Judging Freedom podcast? Also happens to be a former New Jersey Superior Court judge and the former Fox News senior judicial analyst. Very pleased to welcome back to the program my very good friend, Judge Andrew Napolitano. Judge, it's great to have you back. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you, Frank. I love your program, and it's a thrill to be on with you no matter what time of day or night it is.
I appreciate that. There's so much that I want to get into with you. Let's talk the Trump trial. Based on what we've seen of 3 days post-jury selection, we've seen some witnesses, we've seen some back and forth with the judge and the defense over the gag order. What's your read on this situation as it stands now, Judge?
Well, it's difficult to give you a read at this point because the jury selection, in my opinion, was workmanlike and fair. In New York, for those who are unfamiliar with the system, the lawyers picked the jury. So Trump's lawyers participated meaningfully and signed off on the jury. I mean, that's good and it's bad. It's good because it allows the jurors and the lawyers to get in the jurors' heads and have conversation with them and really get to understand how they think. It's bad because they lose the appellate right of the jury was biased or the jury was politically constituted because they signed off on the jury. So New York has the fairest system in the country, actually, when it comes to picking a jury. Most other states, the judge does the questioning, but in New York, the lawyers do it. And this judge did not put any limitation on the questions that Trump's lawyers wanted to ask. In terms of the testimony, even though this has been going on for 2.5 days now, there's only been one witness on the stand, and that's David Pecker. And he's only been under direct examination, so I can't evaluate him as a witness until the cross-examination occurs, which I believe will be later on today. I think the government will probably finish with him by lunchtime. And then after lunch, Todd Blanche will begin cross-examining him. But he paints a very unsavory picture of the former president as a billionaire playboy with the girlfriends all over the place, who then decided to shake him down for money, and he decided to get back at them by buying off their silence without them realizing it. In other words, he sent David Pecker out there, the owner at the time of the National Enquirer, to persuade these people that he would pay them for the exclusive rights to their story. Then he would have a reporter interview them and write up the story. The girls would sign off on the story, and then he would kill it. He wouldn't actually publish it. So that they thought they were being paid for their story, they were actually being paid for their silence. This is a form of fraud, which Trump orchestrated. This is not any of the fraud for which he's on trial, but it demonstrates the pattern of his behavior. In Mr. Pecker's testimony, he has not yet reached the point of the dispute in issue in this case, and that is the payoff of Stormy Daniels. But he's going to get to that probably by 9:30 this morning. David, I know, full disclosure, I know him and for a number of years, is a serious businessman and a credible witness. This is probably very difficult for him because when I knew him, he was best buddies with Donald Trump. And here he is, one of the chief government witnesses against him. It's not an easy thing to do.
I wouldn't think so. You know, you mentioned the makeup of the jury and how this is handled in New York. One of the things that the Trump team has raised, at least in the court of public opinion, and a lot of Trump defenders have raised on the radio and on television, is that it's impossible for former President Trump to get a fair trial because of the makeup of a Manhattan jury, and it's likely to be something that's so politically disadvantageous to him. What's your take on that? Can President Trump get a fair trial in Manhattan?
Yes, he can get a fair trial in Manhattan. Every one of those people under oath said that they can be fair and objective, and they did so to the satisfaction of the three key people involved, the judge, the chief prosecutor, and Trump's chief defense lawyer. A lot of our friends, yours and mine, even people that work with you at WABC and with me across the street, are of the view that Trump can't get a fair trial. But this is a political evaluation, not a legal evaluation. Something happens to jurors when they're sworn and they look at the defendant and they realize that they have his freedom in their hands. And they become a lot more, as a unit, collectively now, serious than you might expect them to be. I have seen this happen many, many, many times. I tried about 150 jury trials in my career as a judge in New Jersey. And again, in that system, I chose the jurors rather than the lawyers doing it. Where the lawyers do it, it is a far more thorough examination than when the judge does it. If Todd Blanche, who's a fine trial lawyer and experienced prosecutor and criminal defense lawyer, this is Trump's chief counsel, is unsatisfied with jury, has nobody to blame but himself because he had every opportunity to influence the makeup of the jury. So I don't believe he's unsatisfied with it. I believe when he told the judge he was satisfied with it, he was truthfully satisfied with it.
One of the things that people are speculating about is whether or not President Trump is going to testify. You mentioned the issue of cross-examination as it relates to David Packer. One of the things that I think the defense is going to consider is what is going to come out if Trump is cross-examined by the prosecutors, meaning other prior bad acts. What are you seeing at this point in terms of the likelihood of Trump's testifying, and what will they be able to ask him about? Are they going to be able to ask him back all the way going back to his grade school days about skipping class and not doing homework? How much are they actually going to be able to ask him about?
They can ask him on cross-examination anything that will materially manifest his credibility. His own sister, a federal judge, now deceased, also a dear friend of mine, she sat in New Jersey, said that he hired students to take his exams at Penn. I mean, that is a dismissible offense and a material black mark on a person's credibility. In this case, it goes back to his, you know, late teenage and early 20 years. Now, it's up to the discretion of the judge how deep into the history of the defendant a cross-examiner can go, but the rule of thumb is the cross-examiner can go anywhere that, as I said, materially affects whether or not the defendant is believable. Now, to the big picture of whether he should testify, man, if I were Todd Blanche and Trump wanted to testify, I'd slip him something in his breakfast so that he was sick as a dog and couldn't come to the courthouse. That would be the worst possible thing for somebody like Trump, to get on the witness stand under oath and be subjected to cross-examination. Under no circumstance should he, but the state's going to try and force him to, because the state is going to elicit testimony. They're going to start this later today. Between Trump and Pecker, only the two of them in the room. Between Trump and Stormy Daniels, only the two of them in the room. Between Trump and Michael Cohen, only two of them in the room. And the only way that the Trump team has to neutralize those three testimonies, and they're the big three in this case, there's going to be dozens of witnesses, but those are the big three, would be to put Trump on the stand. The government wants nothing more to put him than to put him on the stand, because he's a wild man and he can't control himself, and it'll be a disaster for Trump. So, I mean, the rule of thumb is that the defendant only testifies in a criminal case when it's absolutely necessary to prevent the conviction. In this case, it would cause a conviction.
Last question about Trump. How about the gag order? What are you seeing in terms of the gag order? Do you think the arguments in favor of a gag order were pervasive and persuasive?
I have a bias on gag orders, Frank, as you may know from conversations you and I have had. I believe they're unconstitutional. I never issued one. I was never reversed by my decision not to issue it because it's well within the discretion of the trial judge. I believe that the defendant has the right to say whatever he wants. I think that's especially so in this case, not because he is the former president, not because he is a public figure, but because the principal witness against him is all over MSNBC saying this stuff. Donald Trump, that's Michael Cohen, Donald Trump should be able to respond to it. Now, how did it go when they litigated the gag order? It did not go well for Trump. When you have a defendant who has disobeyed a judge's ruling, and it is obvious, you have to admit that. You cannot obfuscate. Cannot deny it, or you will lose all credibility with the judge. And Todd Blanche is very close to doing that. I don't know how you deal with a witness like this. What are you going to do? Put the former president and 15 Secret Service agents in a New York City lockup to deter him from violating the gag order? I mean, that's what the government wants. They run the defendant into a martyr if they do that. How do you fine him? $1,000 a word? That's still peanuts to a billionaire. So I don't know what Justice Merchan is going to do. He's got his hands full with this gag order. It's another reason why it shouldn't have been issued, is to avoid these kind of side litigations, these mini trials like we had on Tuesday that will come up again and again and again over the gag order, because Trump cannot be silent on this. Now, in Merchan's favor, and in the government's favor, they're going to say we can't have the defendant making statements out of the courtroom that reach the jury, because those statements are not cross-examinable. And they're right. You can't have that. But I don't know how you stop it in a case like this, short of incarceration, which raises a host of issues that nobody wants to deal with.
We could do a whole hour just on this, but I want to ask you about one or two other quick issues. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Judge Andrew Napolitano, former New Jersey Superior Court judge. You could check him out on the Judging Freedom podcast. You could just search that on YouTube, and it comes right up. Judge, the issue of FISA, you've been very vocal going back decades about the unfairness and the unconstitutionality of warrantless wiretapping. Now that both the Senate and the House have moved to extend and to some extent expand warrantless wiretapping, how do you feel about this, number one? And as a corollary to that, whenever I bring this issue up, because there's no daylight between your view on this and mine, whenever I bring this issue up, I'm deluged with phone calls, text messages, emails, social media correspondence from listeners, all of whom say the same thing, which is, I've got nothing to hide. Why should I care if the government is listening to my phone calls? If it helps prevent another September 11th terrorist attack or any other crime, God bless them. Let them listen to my phone calls. Give me your take on FISA overall and that mentality that many of our listeners share.
Well, I probably agree with your listeners on many issues, Frank, but not on that. Anybody who has that view does not believe that the Bill of Rights means what it says, that the government can pick and choose which fundamental liberties to protect and which fundamental liberties to assault, then the constitutional guarantees are meaningless and they're subject to the political whims and political winds, W-I-N-D-S, of the moment. The whole purpose of the Bill of Rights is to insulate natural human rights, in this case, the right to privacy, from whatever the government may need at the moment. That's the philosophical argument. The other philosophical argument is, would we be safer if the government could listen to everything everybody says, if the government could bang down any door of any suspect, if the government could beat the truth out of people? You know, we might be, but who would want to live in a society like that? The whole reason that America is, as Reagan said, a city on a hill is because we do have these rights and they are guaranteed. And if the government doesn't guarantee them, then they're gone. Now, in terms of what Pfizer does, the non-debate, they gave Thomas Massey and the opponents of Pfizer 5 minutes on the floor of the House, 5 minutes. The non-debate was about Section 702. 702 of Pfizer permits the government to engage in warrantless, suspicionless surveillance of non-Americans in the U.S. and outside the U.S. and the Americans with whom they communicate. That's the problem here. So the way they do this is they don't listen in real time. They scoop up phone calls, text messages, emails, and other fiber optic data, and they store it. And then when they want to retrieve it, they go and access it. The difficulty is for the Constitution that they make this stored data available to the FBI. So Thomas Massey and Andy Biggs and Chip Roy, the Republicans in the House, there's only a few of them, that believe that the Constitution means what it says, said, fine, we have no problem with that. Go get a warrant before you go into that lockbox.
Right, which makes perfect sense.
Right. That amendment, get a warrant, fell to a tie on the floor of the House. 212 in favor and 212 against. You can't make this up. So the Speaker of the House, who, when he was just a simple congressman from Louisiana, consistently voted against FISA, left the speaker's chair, went down on the floor of the House, and cast the tie-breaking vote against the warrant requirement. In the Senate, almost the same thing happened. It required 60 votes to pass without the warrant requirement, and they got their 60 votes. If it had been 59 votes, it wouldn't have passed. So this allows not only the intelligence community, but law enforcement to get access to communications of Americans. So here's how it works. I call my cousin in Florence, or I text her and say, I'm going to be in Milan in 2 weeks. You'll want to meet for lunch somewhere between Milan and Florence. We haven't seen each other in a couple of years. This is true, by the way. Just because I engaged in that communication, the FBI and the NSA can capture everything that I say. I communicate with Frank Morano. Judge Frank Morano here, can you come on at 1:30 in the morning on April 25th? Sure. That communication exposes Frank Morano to warrantless surveillance. Then Frank calls his next door neighbor about borrowing a lawnmower. That communication allows the intelligence community to surveil the next door neighbor. So you can go these three, what they call hops. If you do this with enough baseline, the original call, these hops become exponential and they could encompass hundreds of millions of Americans who lost their Fourth Amendment privileges. Now, how does this make it worse, this one, than what FISA was 2 weeks ago? Well, your cable installer can now be forced to make your cable accessible to the federal government. And if the cable installer tells you that he has done this, he can be prosecuted. Wait a minute. I thought Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Yeah, that's still in the First Amendment, but they think they can do it anyway. Unless you're a member of Congress, then the cable installer has to tell you. So they wrote a law that destroys the privacy of all people in the United States of America, except the 535 members of the United States Congress. You're telling me that's democracy?
It's crazy. It's an incentive for us to run for Congress, Judge. Final question. I know it's late. You've already been generous with your time. The Columbia protests and the protests that are going on college campuses. I was listening to Mike Johnson on Katz and Cosby telling John Catsimatidis just a few hours ago that Jews at universities are being treated like second-class citizens. They're making some comparisons to what was going on in the run-up to World War II in Germany and the run-up to the Holocaust in Germany.
Our message today was a very important one, and I shared this simple truth that neither Israel nor the Jewish students of Columbia University or anywhere else in this country are ever going to stand alone. And we have a responsibility as elected officials, as members of the United States Congress, to call for an end to this madness. And it is threatening to them. It is intimidating to them. It's terribly discriminatory. Jewish students cannot be treated as second-class citizens. End of sentence.
Where do you stand on the issue of these campus protests? Are these it's college students and administrators and faculty members just administering and they're demonstrating their free speech rights under the First Amendment? Or is there something more sinister here, Judge?
If I were a professor at Columbia Law School, I'd be demonstrating with the students. Absolutely. This is political speech, and they have every right to say what they think of the Netanyahu government. And if we cannot criticize a foreign government that gets billions of dollars from the United States, then something is terribly wrong with our system. It is the affirmative duty of the university, and if they can't do it, of the New York City police, to protect the rights of the demonstrators and to protect the rights of those who feel threatened by the demonstrators. And you don't address that issue by silence. You address that issue by reason and by security. The people that that want to criticize Netanyahu have every right to do so, and the people who feel threatened by it have every right to stay there, to go to school, to live there, and they should not feel threatened by it because there's enough security there to protect them. I don't know where the Columbia administration is going to come down on this, but I believe that the Republicans in the Congress have intimidated college presidents by subtly threatening to withhold aid. I mean, these schools get hundreds of millions of dollars a year from the feds. If the schools don't punish the demonstrators, that's reprehensible. College campuses are the place for the freedom of speech. That's not me. That's federal law, and that's New York State law, and that's New York City law.
It's just so interesting to me that a lot of these conservatives that would go on when liberal students were triggered over some conservative speaker or some conservative demonstration, they would proudly say, oh, no one cares if you're offended. No one cares if you're depressed. No one cares about your feelings. All of a sudden, in this case, when some students are feeling intimidated or anxious or offended, all of a sudden, now we do care about their feelings. It definitely seems a bit inconsistent. Judge, I'm going to let you go. Hey, I'm going to chat with our old pal, Brian Kilmeade, a little bit later. I know you guys used to do a terrific radio show together, Brian and the judge. Any off-the-wall tales of your time together on the radio that I could bring up with him that might either embarrass him or give him a chuckle?
So we had a Christmas party one day. For the whole team, a very expensive Christmas party at the Del Frisco's, one of the most expensive steakhouses in the city across the street from Fox. I turn around and I see five people there. I don't know who the hell they are. I said, Brian, who are these people? So I just met them in the street and I invited them in and I thought I'd put it on your tab. Now, they were military guys that were in the city for the weekend out of uniform. And I think they were being truthful. I don't know. But they ended up getting a very expensive steak meal off of me, not off of Kilmeade. Now, having said that, I love Brian, and I miss him terribly. He'll probably deny that this happens. Brian's attention span and memory are not the best, but I love him as if he were my brother.
Well said, Judge. Thank you so much. It's always a treat to talk with you, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you, Frank. God love you.
Thank you. If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, be my guest. Call us at 800-848-9222. Call me, I should say, 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.